with my favorite 20th century prophet, Martin Luther King Jr., whose birthday is tomorrow, who wrote in 1967, he said, "When machines and computers, profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, extreme materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered." And my favorite 18th century prophet, John Woolman, who said, "Wealth is attended by power, by which bargains and proceedings contrary to universal righteousness are supported, and here oppression, carried on with worldly policy and order, clothes itself with the name of justice and becomes like a seed of discord in the soil." The reason I think of Woolman and King as prophets is that they spoke words years ago that were true at the time they spoke them, and they're still true now. And for me, they communicate a great deal about the plight that we're in and what it has to do with globalization, which I'm going to elaborate a little bit more on what I see as some of the things that are going on that would fall under that category. And I'm going to start in Manchester, New Hampshire, 175 years ago, with the creation of the Amesquieg Corporation, started by financiers from Boston. Well, somewhat 50. How far is it from Boston to Manchester? About what, 50 miles?
35.
Some number of miles, but this was at a time, of course, when there were no email, no fax machines, no automobiles, not even a telegraph. I don't even think there were trains yet then. Were there? Yes?
There were trains.
There were trains. But, I mean, communication between Boston and Manchester was not the way it is now. It actually, you know, in a sense, was pretty far away. But some people in Boston felt like they could run a factory that far away up the river. Within a few years, the Amesquieg mills were the largest textile mill complex in the world. The workforce at first was primarily young women who had left farms and villages in rural New Hampshire, again, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 miles away, and traveled all the way to Manchester, a great distance. Again, not able to communicate with their families by email. They didn't have Yahoo addresses. They didn't have cell phones. They were looking for economic opportunity at a time when the rural economy was not doing so well. Men were already moving further west in search of soil a little less rocky. Think about all those places up around North Sandwich where you're like climbing up the mountains and there's these stone walls indicating there used to be farms. You know, anyway, those people were like getting out of there. The same process was going on throughout New England. New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Rhode Island were becoming dotted with factory towns. Lowell, Lawrence, Franklin, Laconia, Nashua, Keene, all these other places. The dominant industry at the time was the manufacture of cotton cloth. So what were the lives like for the workers, known commonly as mill girls? Here's what one Newmarket mill girl named Octavia wrote in 1843. She said, "What are we coming to? I can hardly clear my way, having saved from 4 weeks steady work but 391 cents. And yet the time I give to the corporation amounts to 14 or 15 hours a day. We are obliged to rise at 6, and it is about 8 before we get our tea, making 14 hours. What a glorious privilege we enjoy in this boasted Republican land, don't we? Here am I, a healthy New England girl, quite well behaved, bestowing just half of all my hours, including Sundays, upon a company for less than 2 cents an hour, and out of the other half of my time, I am obliged to wash, mend, read, reflect, go to church. I repeat it, what are we coming to? What is to make the manufacturing interest any better?" Another writer of the time in 1846 wrote, "Think of girls being obliged to labor 13 hours each working day for a net compensation of just 2 cents per hour, which is above the average net wages being $1.56 a week. 2 cents per hour for severe labor. Is not such a lesson enough to make an American curse the hour when in an evil mood our lawmakers first granted a charter to enable the few to wield the wealth and power of hundreds. So standing for 14 hours a day, 6 days a week, breathing cotton dust, the girls complained about low wages, varicose veins, long hours, denial of opportunity for education, and generally being treated like slaves. And they worried that if they subscribed to a labor publication, if they signed a petition calling for a 10-hour day, they would be fired and blacklisted, prevented from further employment. A guy named Thomas Dublin studied the employment records of Mills and Lowell at the time. In 1836, fully 85% of the workforce was women, most of them between the ages of 15 and 30. The men were in skilled jobs such as machining. The women were machine tenders and weavers. Now, why did women make up the bulk of the workforce? Well, this Thomas Dublin writer says the exclusive employment of women in basic machine tending jobs resulted from the relatively low levels of wages that women customarily received. Women, in short, were thought less likely to demand better treatment, easier to exploit. Within a generation or so, the Yankee mill girls were replaced initially by immigrants from Ireland. And it's interesting, if you look at the history of Ireland, you find that the Irish were not welcomed there, that there were anti-Irish riots in Manchester, and there was an attempt to burn down St. Anne's Church, which was the Irish church in Manchester. The Irish were replaced largely by people from rural Quebec. And there was this huge migration of people who came down from the farms of Quebec. And I think we all know that really within that next period of time, people from French-speaking Canada became the major component of the industrial working class throughout northern New England. Again, in all these towns, Nashua, Manchester, Lewiston, Biddeford, Saco, Rochester, all over the place. By the middle of the 1900s then, or early 1900s, the New England textile industry was largely gone. The Amisquag closed in the 30s, leaving tens of thousands of people unemployed on sort of a moment's notice. The shoe factories gradually left, and where did they go? They went initially to the southern United States, where workers were less well organized, where unions were weaker, where people, in effect, could be more easily exploited. The mill buildings in Manchester and Nashville, all these places were basically left empty for a long period of time. So, what has changed since then? And is this era that we now call, or this process that we now call globalization, is this different? Or what is different about it, of what we face now, than what we've described, what I've been describing about what happened 175, 150, 100 years ago here? A similar process of corporate migration is now underway, only now it's global. Now, somebody can manage factories thousands of miles away in another country more easily than the Boston financiers who ran the Amisquag Corporation could manage the Amisquag mills 50 miles away in their day. Communications technology, transportation technology have made it physically possible, and we're seeing the development, I was going to call it evolution, but that implies a natural process, or perhaps a process inspired by God, depending on how you want to look at it. But so we're not going to call it an evolution, but there is a development of a whole system of global rules governing this new international economy. And it comes under agreements like NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, or under the rules of the World Trade Organization, or these various other systems that we've seen. They make it legally possible and smooth the gears for this process that's going on. So what is the work like now? Well, a few years ago, I came back from a trip to Mexico and went to a New England regional office of AFSC. We had a staff retreat, and our regional director, Keith Harvey, was pleased to pass out these T-shirts that he had gotten printed with AFSC's logo on it, and it said AFSC New England on it. I looked for mine this morning. I couldn't find it. I wanted to bring it to display. But anyway, it was great to get a T-shirt, you know, after all these years on the job. And, of course, being me, the first thing I looked at was the label to see where it had been made. And it was a Hanes T-shirt, and it came from Mexico. It was made in Mexico. And this was great, because I had just come back from Mexico, where I had met a woman named Lydia Guzman, who worked in a factory making Hanes T-shirts. So I said, oh, I know the person who made this. And this is what Lydia said about her work. She lived in the town of Morelos in the state of Coahuila, which is in sort of north-central Mexico, more or less south of Laredo, Texas. And this is what Lydia said about her work. She worked as a 10-member team, all women. Each one was responsible for a single operation, such as sewing a hem on the shirt, around the collar, the sleeve, whatever it might be. She said they got disciplined for talking on the job, and if the machinery broke, they wouldn't get paid. Their quota was 20 dozen T-shirts per hour. So just do a little math for you here. That's 240 T-shirts every 60 minutes. That means 4 shirts every minute. That means 1 shirt every 15 seconds. So, and that's for 8 hours or 9 hours or 10 hours a day. I think probably for 6 days a week. I don't remember for sure. Their pay ranged from 400 to 500 pesos a week, which was somewhere at the time between $1 and $1.40 an hour. And again, $1.40 will go further in Morelos, Mexico than it will go in Concord, New Hampshire. But if you compare it to the cost of living, if you compare what they're earning to the cost of basic products, an exercise I've gone through with other women in northern Mexico, it's not enough money. It's not a living wage. Not even close. And if you then calculate back, look at how much they're getting, it ends up that I don't know what a standard T-shirt might cost if you went to Target or went to some other store, $14 maybe, $15. Out of that, if you do the math, about a nickel goes back to the workers in the Hanes factory out of every T-shirt. I've been fortunate in recent years to travel in northern Mexico, to travel in Honduras, in Guatemala, in Nicaragua, and now most recently in China, and have had the chance to meet workers, mostly young women, who have been working in today's global factory. And as they tell their stories, it almost looks like I'm reading out of the journals of the New Hampshire mill girls from the 1840s. They talk about low pay, they talk about long hours, they talk about hazardous working conditions, they talk about harassment, and they talk about their fear that if they protest or try to organize, that they risk being fired and blacklisted. How far we have come. In the era of globalization, one thing that's different is that it's easier for the companies to pick up and move the factory somewhere else. Not too many years ago, Jack Welch, the illustrious former CEO of General Electric, boasted about relocating a factory from Mexico to Korea in only 45 days, and he said, ideally, you'd have every plant you own on a barge. So you could just tow it around. So in addition now to being fired or worse, workers are frequently threatened with plant closure. Workers are not as mobile as capital, but global economic integration that's going on is also one of the factors that is stimulating a massive migration of people all over the world that's now taking place. So what does this have to do with New Hampshire? Let's start where we started, with manufacturing. While we've certainly seen a lot of jobs leaving, New Hampshire is still a manufacturing state. There's still a lot of manufacturing that's going on here. But the jobs are now by and large low wage and non-union, and many of the workers, especially in assembly factories, are immigrants and refugees, like the old days. They fled from war, they have fled from economic devastation, and they've ended up in New Hampshire. One example, in Mexico, after the passage of the North American Free Trade Agreement, which went into effect in 1994, which forced Mexico to reduce government support for corn farmers in Mexico, not only the basis of largely Mexico's rural economy, but also the basis of much of Mexican culture is in the raising of corn. But because of free trade, Mexico reduced the support that it was giving to corn farmers, and what that meant was that corn raised on industrial farms in the United States with some government subsidies was able to be imported into Mexico at lower prices than the Mexican farmers were able to sell the corn for. In the 10 years since NAFTA has gone into effect, reliable figures suggest that somewhere around 1.3 million Mexican farmers have been, in effect, driven off of their land, off of their farms, because they can't compete with this industrialized corn imported from the United States. Where have they gone? They've gone to the factories, most of which are at the border. And once people are uprooted from villages or communities where they've lived or where their families have lived for generations, it's much more likely that if they don't find something that they want in the community where they've moved, that they're going to pick up and keep going. So many of them continue across the border into the United States. And some of them end up working in factories in Manchester. Recently, a company in Manchester called Car Component Technologies closed down two factories in Merrimack and Bedford. They closed overnight. People went to work on a Thursday, and they were told, your job is gone. Most of them were Latinos from Mexico, from the Dominican Republic, from Puerto Rico, some who were refugees who had come from Africa or other parts of the world were living in New Hampshire. And some of them were people who just a year or 2 years earlier had been laid off in a similar closure at the Jack Pack factory, a meat packing company owned by Tyson, the largest food processor, meat packing and chicken processing company in the country, which bought up a factory in Manchester called Jack Pack had been kind of like the bottom of the labor market in a sense in Manchester for a couple of generations. You know, again, whoever were the people who had the least apparent skills, who were easiest to exploit, oftentimes the most recent immigrants were the ones who went and got jobs at Jack Pack. I talked to an attorney in Manchester once who said like he had put his kids through school, you know, handling workers' comp cases, you know, from Jack Pack for a generation. Tyson bought the factory, closed it down, laying off 500 or so workers. Again, virtually all of them were immigrants and refugees. 1999, a company in Concord, which was called Sprague Electric, had been bought out by a Pennsylvania-based company called Vishay. They employed more than 20,000 people in 60 facilities in 15 countries. The Concord factory had employed as many as 1,000 people. By 1999, it was down to 200. And then the company announced it was going to close the Concord plant entirely. And this is how the Concord Monitor explained it. To improve its bottom line, Vishay has focused on shifting high-cost manufacturing operations in the United States, Germany, and France to countries where labor, property taxes, and utility bills are cheaper and where government development incentives abound. I went by the plant. I was just driving down Pembroke Street one day, and out in front of the factory, there were all these little flags on the ground. And I got out and looked at it. There were these little wires with little pieces of plastic that said, like, Joan and Charlie and Frank on them. And what these were, in effect, were the workers in this factory had gone out and created, in effect, a graveyard for their jobs, with these little memorial markers out on the lawn in front of the factory. By the time I saw it, they were all kind of droopy. They had been out there, I think, for a couple of days, and they were kind of tipping over. It was a very, very, very sad sight to behold. And workers, typically, who are laid off from these manufacturing jobs are getting reemployed, about which more in a moment, but generally are getting reemployed at lower levels of wages and benefits than they were getting in the previous industrial jobs. A guy named Dan Silverstein, who was a Rochester-based shoe importer, told the New Hampshire Business Review a few years ago, he said, in China, he said, quote, you not only have the labor differential, you have no EPA, no OSHA, you don't have fringe benefits that amount to $6 or $7 an hour. So Dan Silverstein is now, instead of manufacturing shoes in Rochester, is importing shoes. Well, I don't know that Dan Silverstein ever actually manufactured a single shoe, but he employed people who manufactured shoes. But instead of doing that in New Hampshire, he's now importing shoes from China. Globalization is therefore putting downward pressure on wages, and wages in this country for most workers have been stagnant since around 1973. They went up a little bit actually in the 90s, and then they went down again, and they're not moving now. Did you have information? I don't know if there's any information about that on your handouts about the minimum wage, but
there is a minimum wage. Anyway.
So what's happening to population is growing. The number of manufacturing jobs in the state has sort of been going up and down a little bit, but it's actually relatively stable over the last period of time. The population, however, is going up. The labor market is going up. The labor the number of people working in New Hampshire has been going up. So what are the jobs being created? The Department of, what are they called, Labor Market Studies and whatever it is at the New Hampshire Department of Employment Security puts out a monthly report called Economic Conditions in New Hampshire. In the most recent one, the story is about projections for job growth. So here are the five categories that are projected to create the highest number of new jobs in New Hampshire over the next few years. Number one, retail sales. Number two, registered nurses. So, you know, any people, registered nursing is actually a good career, or at least it's a skilled career, it's a skilled profession for which there is a demand for jobs. Number three, fast food and food prep workers. Number four, waiters and waitresses. And number five, cashiers. That's where the jobs are. These jobs are typically low wage and low benefit, and those who hold them cannot afford the housing that is currently available in New Hampshire. A third thing I want to talk about is this new system of global economic governance that affects all of us. And while the people who have protested most vociferously, I was in Hong Kong last month during the ministerial meeting of the World Trade Organization, and most of the people who were out in the streets protesting were from the Philippines and from Korea. Not too surprising because they're closer. But it's really people from poor countries that have been the ones who have been most vociferous in their objection to these so-called free trade agreements. There's a whole alphabet soup of these agreements. There's the WTO, there's the GATS, the GATT, there's NAFTA, there's CAFTA, there's AFTA. And if you wanted, I could tell you all about them and what are some of the differences and distinctions. Trying to actually read what these agreements say is very technical and very complicated, and my brain tends to cramp at certain parts of it, although I'm not sure whether I should be proud or embarrassed that I have actually learned to decipher some of the actual trade speak. I'm trying to not become a trade wonk, but I'm trying to actually understand the technical details of these things enough that I can feel confident that when I talk about them, I actually know what I'm talking about. While these things are generally called free trade agreements, it's, I think, more helpful for us to think of them as a new set of rules for all of global commerce, not for what we typically used to think of as free trade. So these rules cover investment. They cover the entire service sector, and that means healthcare, education, construction, the law, the delivery of water, wholesale and retail, transportation, telecommunications. It's all in there. These rules cover migration. They cover intellectual property. In addition to what is the actual trade in industrial and agricultural goods, which when I was a high school student and we talked about what free trade meant and talked about tariffs and things like that, that's what was being talked about during that period of time. Now, free trade is something that covers basically the entire economy and also the workings of government at every level, from your animal control officer, your school board, your water commission, your planning and zoning, your state government, your federal government, all of which is conceivably going to be affected by the operations of this new regime of so-called free trade agreements. Free trade is driving small farmers off the land all over the world. And these rules are ultimately binding here as well as in other places. The three biggest manufacturing employers in New Hampshire are based in other countries. They're BAE, Osram, Sylvania, and Freudenberg. Our two biggest banks, the Citizens Bank, which is a subsidiary of the Citizens Financial Group, which is headquartered in Providence, Rhode Island, which is owned by the Royal Bank of Scotland. Our second biggest bank, which used to be called Bank of New Hampshire, back about 10 years ago, Bank of New Hampshire put out these billboards all over the state that said, "Think globally, bank locally, Bank of New Hampshire." Well, a few years ago, Bank of New Hampshire got bought out by People's Heritage, which was based in Maine. And then People's Heritage got bought out by who, Martha?
Bank North.
Are they called? Became known as Bank North, but then it got bought out by
TD Dominion. TD Dominion is a Toronto,
which is
bank.
Based in Toronto. So our biggest banks in New Hampshire are now international or foreign-owned companies. And our biggest employer in New Hampshire is? Biggest private employer?
Walmart.
Walmart is, of course, based in Benton, Arkansas, but it is a global corporation. It's attuned to the global market. It's also the largest company in the world now, and certainly as a manufacturer or the purchaser of manufactured goods, it's very much attuned to the global labor market.
And Walmart owns Geico.
Owns what?
Geico, which is a car insurance company. Yeah, so this is a big operation.
I thought Buffett owned Geico. Right.
Jimmy Buffett?
No, Warren Buffett.
Anyway. Another thing we could look at to sort of see how New Hampshire fits in with this global economy and potentially is affected by these rules, under these global trade rules, under these trade agreements, is to look at water. Mm-hmm. So here we have a bottle of water, which I purchased for $1.25, which comes to $9.47 a gallon.
Wow.
This. This comes from Fiji. It says on the label, "The taste of paradise." The origin of Fiji, registered trademark. Natural artesian water is rainfall. Which science lesson for us on the hydrologic cycle. Rainfall which over decades filters into an aquifer deep beneath volcanic highlands and pristine tropical forests on the main island of Viti Levu in Fiji. Separated by over 1,500 miles of the open Pacific from the nearest continent, this virgin ecosystem protects one of the purest waters in the world, and you can have it for only $9.47 a gallon.
That's cool. Come to throw your money away.
Yeah, are people really gullible enough?
Yep.
Yeah. Well, sales of bottled water are growing at about 9% a year, and we get junk facts, and there was a junk fax that came in a couple weeks ago that it was all about, you know, some bottled water company and its great growth potential in it. Anyway, yeah.
But this also feeds into like people's lack of science literacy and their nerves about the environment
and their fear about the environment. That's right. So anyway, that's just one place where water and globalization. Over in Nottingham, there is a New Hampshire-based company. It's not a Nottingham-based company, but you've probably heard of it. It's a company that's called USA Springs, and they want to suck some 400,000 or 307,000 gallons of water out of the ground underneath Nottingham and Barrington. It ends up being enough to bottle 1 million bottles of water a day, and they said initially that they want to sell the water in Europe, right? In the Nashua area, we have the Penichuk Water Company, where a few years ago they decided they were going to. They saw that all over the world there were big international water companies were coming in and buying smaller companies, in some cases buying companies that were previously publicly owned, that were being forced to privatize, being forced by the world, usually by the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, coming into a poor country and saying, if you want access to capital for your economy, if you want to keep your currency stable, we'll lend you some money, but one of the things you have to do is privatize your water system, as well as various other conditions which we're going to impose on you. Well, this company in Nashua, which was privately owned, said, here's our chance to cash in. And they cut a deal with a Philadelphia-based company called Philadelphia Suburban, which at the time was actually 20% owned by a giant French company called Vivendi. And what was interesting here was the people in Nashua who had lived with this privately owned water company for 150 years without objection to the fact that it was private rather than public said, no, we don't want that to happen. We're going to take over our water company. And there's now been a process going on. Once the people of Nashua voted to try to take over the company, Philadelphia Suburban said, we're out of here. Vivendi, which was in some other hot water, shall we say, ended up selling its ownership of Philadelphia Suburban. A whole process got started in Nashua. Penichuk is fighting this tooth and nail in saying the city of Nashua is not competent to run a water company. And they're fighting an eminent domain process right now. You know, most people, something like 85% of the people in this country get their water from publicly owned water systems, which, by the way, cost a lot less than this stuff. Penichuk is the most expensive in the state. Anyway, Penichuk has been saying Nashua doesn't have the competence to run a water company. So Nashua now says, no, we're not going to run it. We're going to own it. We're going to hire someone to run it. And who they've chosen is a company called Veolia, which is the new name for the Vivendi Corporation, based in France and one of the two largest water companies in the world. Y'all have heard of Poland Springs. Poland Springs is a subsidiary of the Nestle Corporation, based in Switzerland. They're not currently bottling water in New Hampshire, but they did have two lobbyists at the State House last year, including one who had been previously the acting commissioner of environmental services. So something's going on with Nestle. The Hampton Water Company, another small used to be a small privately owned water company, got bought out by a big American company years ago, which then sold it. It's now a subsidiary of something called Aquarian, which is owned by a British company called the Kelda Group. So Hampton Water is owned by a foreign corporation. The last one I'm going to mention right now, in your part of the world, in Moultonboro, there was up at the Castle in the Clouds, there was a company called Castle Springs, which at least used to boast that they sold water throughout something like 26 states and throughout the Caribbean. A couple years ago, Castle Springs got bought out by a California-based company called Crystal Geyser Roxanne, but I think that the Roxanne part is actually a French company. And Crystal Geyser Roxanne also has some type of relationship with a Japanese conglomerate called Otsuka Pharmaceuticals. If you look at Otsuka's website, it makes it look like this Crystal Geyser Roxanne is a subsidiary. So I don't know whether the water from Moultonboro is still being sold throughout the Caribbean, whether it's being sold in Japan and France. I'm not sure. But there's clearly a web of international connections and ownership. And under these trade rules, water, certainly if it's bottled, is a tradable good, and regulation of it, according to the U.S. Trade Representative, is covered by trade rules under the World Trade Organization or NAFTA, CAFTA, AFTA, or whatever comes after these things, whatever comes next. If you're a company that's investing in a water bottling plant or a water utility, then your investment is covered by the investment rules that are embedded in these trade agreements. And the service sector operations and occupations that are associated, whether we're talking about architects designing plants or construction and engineering to create and operate them, or get the water plumbing from the water plant to your house so that when you turn on the tap, legal services, wholesale and retail services, transportation services, all of these are covered under the services chapters of these agreements. And if your government enacts rules which are considered overly burdensome to the companies which are trying to engage in these services, then your laws or regulations can be challenged as unfair trade practices under the terms of these free trade agreements. So the ability of our government at all levels to regulate water in the public interest is threatened by the existence of this new emerging web of global trade rules. Another part of this picture has to do with what we could call the ideology that underlies the mechanics of globalization. Sometimes it's called market fundamentalism. When people are talking about international finance and the behavior of the what the philosophy or ideology or and economic theories that underlie the practices of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, the term that's usually used is the Washington Consensus. Our government, while these are international lending agencies, the government of the United States is the big player behind them, really acting in a sense on behalf of the financial sector in this country. So you can think of these as entities that represent the interest of creditors in the global economy. Their ideology favors the private market over the public sector, and in other words, you could say that it favors decisions that are made by those who control private wealth over decisions that are made by democratically accountable institutions. This affects a lot of issues that we care about, and the reason I mentioned that it's called the Washington Consensus overseas is because we are, of course, here affected by the Washington Consensus as well. And it also underlies or affects or infects the operations of government here. So we could talk about what in Washington during the Clinton years was called welfare reform, which Martha and I always called welfare deform, because the idea was that the government was going to be less involved in actually promoting and providing and assisting people, again, mostly women who, and children who were in need, whose needs were not being met by the private market. The government is now taking a step backward there. We're seeing decreases of public investment in affordable housing. The government stepping back from the provision of health care, turning it over to the private sector. The government stepping back from education. We see these mechanisms for charter schools and such as part of a privatization of the education process. They're using taxes to subsidize private education. Proposals to privatize Social Security, which, while they're not going anywhere, fortunately, in Washington right now, is part of the same ideology. The undermining of the minimum wage. When's the last time the minimum wage went up, Martha?
1987.
New Hampshire is the only state in New England that abides by the federal minimum wage. The other states all have minimum wages that are higher. Vermont's is
over
$7 an hour.
Maine is over $7.
We're not really seeing a massive flight of businesses from Vermont to cross the river into New Hampshire as a result of the minimum wage go up, as far as I can tell.
Last I knew, there was still sky over, the sky had not fallen over Maine and
Vermont because their minimum wages were higher. But really, the attitudes of our elected officials on these is not all that different from the attitude that leads to the flight of jobs overseas and the government deciding that not only is it not going to do anything about those things, but it's going to ease the way and that in the end it will be good for everyone. The unwillingness of the government to do anything about the causes of global warming, feeling that the interests of the oil companies are more important than the rest of us, is part of this. In a document that's called the National Security Strategy of the United States, which you can read at whitehouse.gov, begins with these words from President George W. Bush. It says, "The great struggles of the 20th century between liberty and totalitarianism ended with a decisive victory for the forces of freedom and a single sustainable model for national success: freedom, democracy, and free enterprise." And one of the longest chapters in this document, along with the ones about weapons of mass destruction and things like that, but there's one that's called "Ignite a New Era of Global Economic Growth Through Free Markets and Free Trade." So this ideology and these mechanisms and this process of globalization is now part of what the Bush administration, at least, sees as essential for our national security. And we all know what happens to anyone who challenges their notions of what is good for our national security. So when the government of Iraq was overthrown, one of the first things that George Bush proposed was creating a Middle East free trade area. And recently we've seen the negotiations of free trade agreements with Bahrain and Oman, and we're seeing forced privatization in Iraq and Iraq being opened up to international investment as a result of U.S. control of the economy there. So what would John Woolman say about all this? I think he'd say, "Wealth is attended by power, by which bargains and proceedings contrary to universal righteousness are supported. And here oppression, carried on with worldly policy and order, clothes itself with the name of justice and becomes like a seed of discord in the soil." And what would Martin Luther King say? When in a letter from the Birmingham jail, he talks about, he's actually talking about liberal clergy persons, but he talks about those who favor order or believe that who value order more than they value justice. And later he said that when machines and computers, profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, extreme materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered. That's what Woolman and King said. What do we say?
We won't give up.